Speaking of, here's Darius Dale. Darius thinks that's funny. Yeah. Darius, where's
that
the
was
coffee?
Hilarious, dude.
Right? I mean, is that not the game?
I'm sorry if I was laughing in the background. That was great.
I love that you showed up in the Diamond Hand shirt.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Is it not dope?
It's phenomenal. It's, I'm taking these to go, actually.
Yeah, no. Whoa.
Oh, hey, Diamond Hand shirt and Jordans.
Yeah. Oh, come on, man. Get the camera on these. Yeah, I still got it a little bit. Side of the tank. What's up, boys?
We got a lot to talk about.
Yeah, ton to talk about.
The Fed, are they just being little babies and they don't want to actually raise rates by 50 basis points? What's going on with the 25 basis points? I said they're bringing a water gun to an inflation war yesterday.
No, yeah. I mean, so these guys are firefighters, right? I mean, that's it. I mean, imagine like the you know, showing up to 9/11 with a water gun. And that's effectively what they're doing. You know, so the markets enjoyed that yesterday. A lot of what happened with the market response is a function of the derivatives markets dynamics. You have OPEX, options expiry this tomorrow. And so a lot of those puts are coming, they're coming off the table, and that's causing this sort of mechanical lift to the market. But the reality is the Fed more or less told you yesterday they're going to mechanically raise interest rates and mechanically shrink its balance sheet until they break something. Now, they're never going to say we're going to break something. And that's sort of implied by their growth forecast, where growth never goes below trend, employment rate never goes above trend. But they've got interest rates, if you look at the dot plot, going both above trend. And so it's pretty clear that the markets and the economy are on a collision course for the Fed to break something. It's just a matter of when, not if.
Is it guaranteed that they're going to break something?
It's not guaranteed, but let's be realistic, right? Like the Fed operates in this sort of vacuum whereby they believe monetary policy has, quote unquote, long and variable lags. That's one of the creepiest things they say. They always say it and like look shiesty when they say it. But I mean, and this is true, right? We know monetary policy operates with long and variable lags, but those lags have become shorter, right? There's so much forward guidance now. Every time they open their mouths, the markets take what they're saying and reprice it into bond markets, into rates markets, into equity markets, et cetera. And so those lags have shrunk over time. It's impossible to measure how long the lag is. But what I mean by this is at the end of the day, they're not going to know they've broken something until the markets tell them they've broken something. That's the problem. Inflation is not going to come down fast enough to get them off of this policy path.
Why did they only do 25 basis points and not 50? Were you surprised by that?
No, I'm not surprised by it because the markets were pricing in 25. If you look at sort of the Fed does not like to surprise markets, at least not going back to the Bernanke Fed and Yellen Fed. Greenspan wouldn't mind surprising. Obviously, Paul Volcker didn't mind pissing people off. But the reality is in this new Fed regime, it's very unlikely that the Fed will ever do anything that's not priced into the market for that meeting. And so only 25 basis points were priced in. And part of it, obviously, we've got a lot of volatility. Russia, Ukraine is a big big risk. But the reality is they don't have a choice. They're doing the littlest they possibly can do, but they're going to do the littlest they possibly can do for as long as they can possibly do it until something breaks.
So is it fair to say they're just going to keep doing like 25 basis points every meeting as of right now, unless something changes, just 25 basis points every meeting until inflation comes down?
Yeah. So, I mean, we obviously going back to our last week's discussion, you know, we all know at least the four guys in the room or four and a half, five guys in the room. We all know that inflation's going up in March. I don't think anybody's going to be shocked by that. We could see in May when the Fed does its meeting in May, it's very likely that they outline quantitative tightening, which is when the Fed shrinks its balance sheet, basically sends all the liquidity dynamics going in the reverse way for risk assets. And so we're going to get the data on that. They might choose to speed up their policy tightening projections or tighten it 50 basis points at that meeting. But what's more likely to happen is they maintain this sort of 25 basis points per meeting outline and just use the balance sheet as kind of the flex tool, if you will.
Yeah. It's does that mean that a recession is the only outcome now? Like if they keep doing this, then we just get recession?
Yeah. So here's the problem again with markets, right? The Fed believes, and according to their dot plot, according to their projections, which again are ridiculous, they're going to take, so I sent you a few charts. I don't know if you had time to load them up or not, but one of the charts is called dot plot, where we show the Fed's, you know, the 1 year and the 2 year forecast for the Fed funds rate relative to their longer run rate. And this is the first time, if you look at their 2 year projection, that we've seen the dot plot, their dot plot go into restrictive territory, i.e. they think the federal funds rate is going to be higher than the level of federal funds rate that is that'll cause the economy to slow. And so, you know, that's a meaningful signal in and of itself. But they didn't change their GDP or their unemployment rate projections to say that they're going to go below trend. They're going to go below a level that is sort of indicative with a healthy expansion. So that's a ridiculous expectation. And so to answer your question, will we go into recession? There's no guarantee that we have to go into recession. It's that the conditions are in place for a recession to occur, particularly given that the Fed is likely to be tightening for longer than it should.
And started later than they should.
And started later than they should. This is the lowest. I told you, we've been talking about this for a while now. This is the that was the lowest the unemployment rate has ever been at the beginning of a tightening cycle. That's the second tightest that the yield curve has ever been if you look at the 10s-2 spread at the beginning of a tightening cycle. And so, you know, what those two indicators are telling you is, one, the unemployment rate being as low as it is that we're pretty late in the business cycle. And then number two, the yield curve being as tight as it is, as narrow as it is telling you that we're not only late in the business cycle, but we're already slowing cyclically to a place that, you know, to undetermined location. But that undetermined location has a very high or very reasonably high probability of being a recession.
Yeah. It's fascinating when you start to think about they're going to keep doing this. If we go into a recession, they might not necessarily reverse course right away either. Like they're so slow to act based on this data. What would be the alarm bell to them? Like if stocks drop 20%, would they step in and could they do an emergency rate cut or what would they do?
Yeah, so great question. So to me, that is the problem for markets this year. It's that because the Fed got started so late, there's going to be, and because inflation momentum continues to accelerate, we talked about the acceleration in median CPI and the broad basedness of inflation, the acceleration in sticky CPI. Both of those numbers are running at 6.5% on a month-on-month annualized basis. Those numbers are way too high for in terms of a 2% core PC target. And so in terms of like what can stop, prevent a recession, prevent the Fed from tightening us into a recession, the only thing that's going to tell them is financial conditions. And that's actually the first chart I showed you. I sent you the financial conditions chart where the red line shows the Goldman Sachs Financial Conditions Index. And I'll summarize kind of how that works. When the index value is low in that particular chart, what we're showing here is financial conditions are easy. So you know, the equity valuations are high. Credit spreads are very tight. You know, the dollar is weak. You know, all the things that would be supportive for like the price of Bitcoin. All those things are good. When the financial conditions index is high, it's telling you the reverse is true. Valuations are low. Credit spreads are wide, dollar strong, you know, you have disinflationary forces in the market. And so right now, financial conditions are still extremely loose by all standards. You pull the chart back far enough and you realize like, hey, look, they're still as easy as financial conditions were at the peak of the tech bubble back in 2001 or back in 2000. And so there's a long way to go in terms of the markets having to finally tell the Fed to stop. And so ultimately that tells me that, look, the downside for something like the stock market could be another 10, 20% from here. Mm-hmm. Pretty easily. I mean, in terms of where we calculate the Fed put, we do it through a variety of different lenses, whether it be policy or looking at historical analogs, this current growth, inflation, policy setup or positioning setup for that matter. We get to like basically down 29 to down 34% peak to trough for the S&P 500 pretty consistently across those nine different frameworks. Not, you know, so we were somewhere between, let's call it 3,200 and 3,400 on the S&P. We don't even need to get into recession before. If we saw 34 on our S&P, the Fed will be cutting rates. And so the only thing, in my opinion, that will prevent a recession is if the financial markets collapse enough to tell the Fed to stop.
Yeah. So that's basically what they're looking for. It's like, we're going to keep doing this until we see somebody yell uncle, essentially. Yeah. And really, it's asset prices, even though they're not focused on asset prices.
I'll rephrase it, actually. what Jay Powell said yesterday is we're going to do this and stick the landing perfectly and perfectly slow the economy, bring demand in line with this new reduced level of supply, both labor supply and also, you know, shipping and all that stuff. Bring demand perfectly in line with this new level of supply, even though 6 months ago we didn't realize it was a low level supply causing elevated inflation. But somehow we're going to perfectly stick this landing. But obviously all of us in financial markets are watching this like, you're not going to perfectly stick this landing. You're going to over tighten or you're going to tighten until the market breaks. Either or, it's both of those are bad outcomes in my point. So we're sort of headed for a very negative kind of decision tree, if you will. The only thing that's a positive outcome in between all of this is a ceasefire in Russia, Ukraine. But I'm not even sure how positive that is, right? I mean, it's positive from the perspective of not losing any more human life and human suffering. But if we don't remove the sanctions and Russia still sort of separate and apart from the rest of the global financial world, and China and Russia are doing this, and the U.S. and Europe are doing that. If those things don't change, then the real true bear case associated with the Russia and Ukraine as it relates to financial markets won't change. And so I worry about investors that are sort of gearing. There's a lot of investors that are fearful of having short exposure right now. And in fact, in OpEx, are about to lose about 1/3 of all S&P, you know, NASDAQ type put exposure on Friday. People are kind of scared to put that on. You can sort of sense that because, one, the Fed is not being overly draconian. They're going to be measured in their how much they destroy the economy and financial markets. So that's positive at the margin relative to prior to the meeting when they could have been unmeasured. They could have been unhinged. So they took that off the table. But in the context of losing all that put exposure, losing all that short exposure, people are afraid of this Russia-Ukraine catalyst. Like, what if they shake hands on Sunday? What if they shake hands on Monday? What if they shake hands on Tuesday? But the reality is once they shake hands, you get rid of that positive catalyst and you look forward next month, the month after that, the quarter after that, the quarter after that, and there's no positive catalyst for a while.
What should I do? I was going to ask, what did you think of the market's reaction yesterday? I mean, the S&P was down a bit, but it bounced right back. Bitcoin, same thing. Did you make anything of that or no?
Yeah, so the market's reaction yesterday was somewhat interesting. I mean, it was to be expected. So as long as they didn't effectively say we're going to tighten until something breaks, you know, Powell said what he had to say in the press conference to sort of assuage those fears. And so what happened yesterday is that a lot of the sort of puts and short positions that were open, let's call it back in January, back in February, early March, to account for this meeting and also to maybe position for some of the Russia-Ukraine dynamics, those puts, they get covered. They get sold, you know, bought back or sold or, mm-hmm. you know, so what happens is those positions get closed. And so the closing of those positions, because they're being offset by hedges, you know, by people who sold you those puts, they're caught, you know, the closing of those hedges is causing the market to rise. So it's not like a fundamental choice of investors saying, this was a positive outcome, therefore I got to buy stocks.
Yeah.
It's more like this was not as bad as an outcome as I thought, therefore I got to close my short.
Yeah.
And that's what happened yesterday. And so those types of dynamics do perpetuate meaningful market, you know, squeezes in, you know, particularly in bear markets. The problem is in order for that to sustain, you actually need good news. You need a series of good news, and the easiest series of good news and the one that matters most for financial markets across long periods of time is accelerating growth. Well, we don't have accelerating growth. We have a globally synchronized slowdown. Whether you look at China, Europe, U.S., all the major economies in the world are slowing down simultaneously right now. So that's out the picture. You look at policy. What could, you know, cause a meaningful, sustainable shift? Well, obviously the Fed's doing the reverse in terms of policy. There was a headline on Wednesday morning about China with this rhetorical shift in China. They had a meeting basically sort of stop the bleeding, stop the massive crash in Chinese stock markets. And they sort of kind of spooked the market in terms of saying, hey, look, not spooked the market to the upside in terms of saying, hey, look, we're talking about more stimulus, more of this and that. They haven't followed through yet. And if they don't follow through, then that's going to be a hard sell in terms of, you know, all the relief rally we saw in China. So, again, this is a tough year if your goal was to sort of try to make money and compound returns, because the reality is there's so many headwinds working against that, unfortunately.
Historically, I think the government has kind of played the approach of kick the can down the road. Is that kind of the playbook that you're seeing them say now, which is the 6 or 7 rate hikes throughout the year, small rate hikes kind of gradually introduced, or like are they kind of taking action now?
So I'll start by saying they're definitely not kicking them in these. I mean, you know, that's a good question. So they're doing what they have to do. They could do more, but obviously, given the geopolitical situation, they don't want to do more, right? Like they want to do the least amount possible, while also at the same time, sort of, given the appearance of returning the economy back to price stability, to borrow a quote from Powell. And so, you know, could they do more? Could they accelerate in the future? Sure, yeah, that's a likelihood. I don't think that they're going to. I think what's more likely to happen is that this thing is going to be like watching paint dry until it isn't. And eventually what's going to happen is the Fed is going to bring the policy rate and the balance sheet to places that the market won't like in the context of the economy slowing down. And right now, if you look backwards, the economy is doing just fine, right? Real consumer spending is still at an elevated level. Retail sales came out yesterday. They decelerated, but there's still decent growth rates. PMIs are still comfortably above 50. 6 months from now, none of that stuff will be true. It's very unlikely for that stuff to be true. In fact, chart I wanted to show is the last one, the energy crisis slide. So the chart shows, you know, energy, crude oil prices, And then it shows the trailing 2-year change in crude oil prices. And so, you know, whenever you go above 100% on that trailing 2-year change, like it's effectively an energy price shock. And you pull this all the way back to the 1970s. Whenever you have an energy price shock, you know, one of two things tends to happen. We go into recession, the stock market collapses, or both of those things happen at the same time. The 2005, going back to 1970, has been like, you know, let's call it six or seven or eight of these episodes, these dynamics. 2005 is the only one that didn't end in a recession or a market collapse. And so this is still ahead of us, right? Like this is still something that's in the pipeline coming down the pike, you know, as months and quarters are ahead of us.
Do you think we get 7 rate hikes this year?
It's unlikely. I think at some point the Fed's going to have to pivot dovish, right? Inflation's not going to be that signal. So they have three. Let's go back to what's the Fed trying to do here? Maintain price stability, promote maximum inclusive unemployment or employment. So there's sort of two stated mandates, right, from Congress. Those are the two mandates. And then there's a sort of third hybrid mandate because they understand how financialized the economy is, right? Like, and the hybrid mandate is financial conditions, like is the stock market up enough or, is, you know, stuff like that. So we know inflation's not going to come down at any point in time over the next 12 to 18 months for them to say, mission accomplished, let's start cutting rates. I mean, that's out. That signal is a year or two from now. The unemployment rate going up is a breaking of something in the economy. Typically, the unemployment rate doesn't go up until you get into recession. And so that would obviously catalyze as a breaking, so they want to avoid that. So it tells you in terms of their mandate, their three mandates, financial conditions is the only mandate where they're going to get feedback to say, stop doing what you're doing, which means the market has to go down, you know, in order for this Fed to not effectively cause a sharp rise in the unemployment rate. It's like either that's going to happen and drag the market down because of it, or the market just has to go down sooner than that occurs so the Fed can stop. And to answer your question, I don't know when that is going to occur specifically. It's impossible to know that in real, you know, ahead of time. I have views on when that might start to occur. The earliest that could start to occur, at least according to our growth models, is sometime in mid to late Q2. I don't think it'll be mid to late Q2 in terms of the Fed pivot. It's probably going to be something that looks like Q4. So you're probably going to have like a nasty summer and fall from a financial market perspective in order for the Fed to sort of get the memo that, look, you've already done enough.
So is it fair to say we'll get close to 7 maybe, but not?
Probably four or five, you know.
Four or five.
And you know, a couple hundred billion, $300-400 billion in QT.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Fed, markets might not like the outcome. Because, again, the number one problem, I've said this since every day or every other day at least, since, I don't know, probably beginning of November, the number one problem with 2022 is growth expectations. You know, the world, the Bloomberg consensus economists, is Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan, all these economists that get paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to put out these forecasts, they continue to believe that the U.S. economy is going to grow above its potential growth rate in 2022. As recently as this morning, with everything we know that's happening in the geopolitical sphere, Fed hiking interest rates, you know, obviously financial conditions tightening, they're still talking about 160 basis points higher than our potential growth rate. That's obviously not going to happen. So those numbers need to come down. And so the fact that those numbers need to come down at the same time, we don't really have a real good sense of what the terminal destination is on the downside risk in terms of the economy. The fact that those two things are happening simultaneously creates a lot of market risk.
Darius, if you had no investable assets and you had $5,000-$10,000 today, would you put it to work or would you hold it for an opportunity cash in case of a recession or something like that?
It depends on what my duration is. So I would split that up. Let's say if I had 10 grand, I'd take 5,000 and say, this is my long-term, this is my pension fund retirement type accounts. You dollar cost average of that. You know, don't try to be a hero with that. For the other half, I would say this is more my tactical. I can use this to take advantage of big dislocations in the market. And then I would be waiting on that to buy, let's call it, using Bitcoin as an example. I would diamond, I would two hands it somewhere around 28,000, 29,000.
Yep. So I've been over here doing deep research, trying to figure out.
You've been quiet, yeah.
I've been trying to figure out what the average person, if they said, hey, a recession's potentially coming. And so I figured they probably would Google something like best way to invest in a recession.
Yeah.
Right? Some sort of search term like that. And the first thing you get is an ad that says recession-resistant asset. Invest in farmland, high IRR.
Yep.
Okay. And of course, they have all the normal things. Farmland outperformed the S&P 500. It's a stable, high-yielding asset, yada, yada, whatever. Mm-hmm. Net IRR, 7, 8%. Cash yield, 2.5%, et cetera. So addresses recessionary-type period, but not necessarily inflation, yeah, given the yield that it drives. Then there are articles that say five things to invest in when a recession hits. And the five things that they say, number five is invest in yourself.
Yeah, agree.
Okay. Number four, purchase precious metals. Number three, consider buying real estate. Number two, focus on reliable dividend stocks. And number one, seek out core sector stocks. And it is not the best time to flee equities completely, according to experts. When I see that, I think to myself, precious metal investments, what we've seen in the past is in the recessionary periods, gold and other metals go down just as much as other assets.
Yes, particularly when financial conditions get crazy.
Yeah. Two is real estate's out of touch for most people, right, in terms of they can't just on the dime go and buy real estate. So they either got to go into some sort of REIT or something or whatever. And then the advice is like core sector stocks or reliable dividend stocks, which doesn't necessarily feel like that's going to outperform in a recessive period either. So I kept going. And I went to a number of different, what I would consider asset management firms, media companies, et cetera. And if I look at this one, it says, what are the best industries to invest in during a recession? Discount retailers, consumer staples, healthcare utilities, service and repair companies, sin industries, like alcohol, tobacco, marijuana, chocolate, static industries. Funeral services, healthcare, and real estate. I kind of look at it, and it's like...
I keep telling you to buy stocks. I don't understand this. These lists.
Yeah.
Who put these lists together? Like Mutual Fund Company of America? Like.
Then it says 11 tips for what to do. Yeah. Gold is good. Invest in real estate. Keep the recession-proof stocks you have. Buy recession-proof stocks. Earn money during a recession with dividend stocks. Lower your risk with treasury bonds. Keep the lights on. Buy utilities. Honor your elders, invest in healthcare and senior living, hit your 401k contribution, protect your portfolio, be cash heavy for now.
It's like five, like that was five different like
ways to say
independent
the same thing.
Orthogonal lanes of like investment decision making.
So like the reason I went and I looked at it and read all that is like the advice seems just not very helpful.
This is
right
why,
that people are getting.
This is why my company exists. I mean, this is the kind of stuff you get when you Google, as opposed to asking someone who has a, you know, a background in institutional finance and quantitative ability to actually get you to the right answers. I mean, if you want to talk about what to invest in a recession, this first starts with having capital to invest in a recession. So that means don't lose a significant chunk of your assets along the way to a recession, which is generally when a lot of the actual pain takes place. Markets tend to bottom in recession, right? They don't bottom after recession. They bottom during the recession. And so, you know, you got to make sure that you're not overly long, you know, high beta risk assets. Quite frankly, that's the best thing I can say is like, look, right now is not the time to be levered long high beta risk assets. There's probably more downside, more pain to come. And if you can avoid, you know, just taking a 10, 15, or even 20 to 30% drawdown of your capital, man, you are going to be really set up to take advantage of some price dislocations, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 9 months from now, 12 months from now, who knows when we see, you know, kind of the whites of the eyes of the nadirs for a lot of these charts. But, you know, it starts with, you know, being smart about the decisions you make leading into recession. And then when you're in recession, you know, assuming you did your job well and didn't lose a significant chunk of your assets, then it's okay. I don't want recession-proof stocks. I want to buy stocks that'll do well when the economy's recovering, you know, in the middle of the recession, you know, when they're actually cheap. I want to go buy assets like Bitcoin that somebody had to sell because they needed liquidity, and then I can, you know, buy it, you know, relatively cheap, you know, for the next halving cycle. That, to me, is the appropriate strategy. This is the whole point of what I do for a living, is to figure out where we are in this market and economic cycle and say, hey, look, probably a good time to sell, probably a good time to buy. I make a lot of decisions along the way for institutional customers, generally speaking, and they get a lot of value out of those pivots because that's what they're trying to do all day. But generally speaking, for the average investor, there's only about, you know, let's call it one or two big pivots you need to make per year. And going back to the late last year, last fall, going back to early November in particular, the big pivot you needed to make was, okay, I need to not be long too many high beta risk assets. And then eventually the next big pivot, I think, will be when do you buy bonds heading into a sharper deceleration in growth.
Last thing I want to talk about, Bitcoin, positive or negative if we watch the Fed play out how they want to play out? Do you think that it reacts positively or no?
No, it's unfortunate. It's unlikely to react positively. I am very encouraged by how it's traded. I mean, I think it has made a new low since like late January.
We don't talk about lows around here.
Yeah. No, that's super encouraging. And so, you know, one, it's telling you that like the ultimate bear case, right? Like, let's play it forward. 6 months from now, 9 months from now, everything I'm talking about today will be, you know, more readily available in data and charts. You know, you have an earnings slowdown, you have operating margins, and, you know, companies, corporations contracting. You're going to have real income still negative, consumer spending much lower than it is currently in terms of growth rate terms. You know, going to have a lot more sort of obvious pain. And I think that process of going from today where the economy and the economic outlook is still fairly rosy amongst consensus, you know, again, consensus believes that oil is a problem and the geopolitical situation is a problem, but they don't believe that fundamentally, inherently, the economy is a problem. And we definitely see enough underneath the hood in terms of consumer confidence and decline in real incomes that would seem to suggest that that's the wrong position to take. So the path to go from today where everything's fine as long as you get rid of these exogenous shocks to, oh, no, it wasn't just the exogenous shocks. We actually were mired in a cyclical slowdown and the Fed is actually making this thing worse. That process, in our opinion, won't be great for Bitcoin or risk assets broadly. But, I mean, you're certainly going to want to have, you know, I think it's, it could Bitcoin bottom, you know, at some point in summer or fall this year and bottom ahead of stocks or bottom ahead of credit, most likely. You know, it's a global asset. It's a much more free market.
Are you guys going to sell your Bitcoin if we go into a recession?
No.
No, I'm curious, recession-proof stocks, what would be an example of some?
Well, now, obviously, like a defense company, right? unfortunately, you know, some like a recession-proof stock is like something where the demand is inelastic. You know, so, you know, like tobacco,
food, and stuff, food like that,
and stuff like that. But that doesn't mean the stock doesn't go down in price. It just means it's probably going to go down in price less than the broader market. Right?
Gotcha.
Like that's what the sort of mutual fund game is. It's like I outperform by not being down as much, which is
Because I Googled recession-proof stocks just to see what the common person would get as an answer. It said 7 stocks that soar in a recession from U.S. News. Netflix, Target, Lowe's, Home Depot, Walmart. What are your thoughts on those?
I don't think
pretty sure Netflix was Netflix a stock in the previous recession prior to the COVID lockdown?
Probably not.
It might not even been public. Like, what are they talking? Yeah, this is the stuff I'm talking about. This is
Home
why
Depot
I wake
soars
up.
Soars during.
There's so many people getting this ridiculous information when they Google stuff.
That was the first thing that comes up on Google.
Yeah, I mean, this is no wonder people are frustrated with Wall Street. I mean, I would be frustrated with Wall Street too if that was the outcome. I didn't realize they were still doing that kind of crap.
I personally think that we should just go buy casino stocks. That's what it feels like.
MGM's cheap.
Yeah. Yeah. Netflix is down 50% over the last 3 months. So,
and we're not in recession, by the way.
Perfect time to buy.
We're not in recession, dude. No, yeah. I mean, look, this at the expense of using a word that I loathe as a quantitative analyst, but this feels a lot like the unwind of the dot-com bubble, where it's like there's just a long period of time where there's not going to be any really, truly supportive news for the market. You know, the Fed is tightening pro-cyclically, i.e. they're tightening into the slowdown, and we'll be doing that for an extended period of time. Obviously, we're not going to get any real resolution on the geopolitical front for a while. Obviously, they can come to a ceasefire. That's temporary resolution. But the real resolution comes back in integrating Russia back into the dollar system and the global economy. I don't see that occurring anytime soon. And then ultimately, you still have China, Taiwan out there as a tail risk. So,
can I ask a question that has nothing to do with finance or economics?
Yeah, of course, always.
There's a situation that I've been paying attention to. I usually don't pay attention to this stuff, but I feel like it's gotten a little crazy now. Kim Kardashian, Kanye West, and Pete Davidson. This has gotten Pete Davidson's going to space. Kanye West got kicked off Instagram. Kim Kardashian is telling people that Pete Davidson got branded with her name on it. I'm shook.
What's happening right now, man?
The reason why it's interesting is because Pete Davidson is going to space. Going to like low orbit space or whatever.
With Blue Origin.
With Blue Origin, like on the commercial, like on the So like what I've been thinking about, I was like, holy shit, like Pete Davidson is going like that. It must be accessible enough now where like they're going to start doing this regularly and people are going to go to space. Like, that seems kind of crazy
is
to
Pete
me.
Pete Davidson Kagan off SNL like that?
Listen, some tell me this is the marketing play. You know,
I don't know.
Kanye bullied him off Earth.
Yeah. I was going to say, I don't think Pete Davidson.
And then
got
Pete
the funds,
and Kanye come out with a double banger.
I know.
On the next album.
I know.
Pete and Colin Jost bought an old Staten Island ferry.
Who?
Pete and the other SNL host, Colin. They bought a Staten Island ferry. Yeah. They got, well, they got
those
some cash.
Can't be that
Kim
expensive.
May be paying too. We don't know.
We don't know. Yeah.
By
nah, he
NYC.
Released a movie recently. He's got cash.
He's got cash. I mean, I don't know how much it costs to go, but.
Well, I mean, to my knowledge, the only people who've been in space are like, you know, old rich white dudes. So I didn't know Pete Davidson had it like that.
Michael Strahan's going to space.
Say what?
Michael Strahan.
No, he already went.
He went. I think he's going to get
it. Michael Strahan went to space?
Yeah.
How much it costs to go to space?
Nah, I think, I'm looking up right now. They said tickets on Virgin Galactic's is $450,000 right now.
I don't know if I'm going on
that. It started at $250,000, now it's $450,000. Blue Origin selling them for $1 million.
Serious inflation, dude. Yeah. The inflation's rich people.
Blue Origin's
you're gonna have rich people picketing outside the Fed because they can't afford to go to space.
Blue Origin said they sold $100 million worth of space tickets.
Wow.
Yeah, they just right off the bat,
bro.
$1 million bucks.
Not, I wouldn't pay
it's
a million,
not space.
But if it was like $100K,
it's a 12.
It's like you could buy two Ferraris or something for that, or you could
go
to space one time.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. You go to space twice, or you could buy one Ferrari, like.
Michael Strahan, William Shatner is going to space.
Strahan, when he came back,
yeah, he's going again.
By the way, have we confirmed that they're coming back? Because I feel like all the rich people are getting out of here, and eventually, like, we're gonna get a memo in like 6 months. Like, oh yeah, there's an asteroid coming.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going on.
Conveniently, they're flights.
Have we confirmed these people come back?
Has anyone seen them on land? Since,
I know. Yeah, exactly.
Since then.
Yeah.
Oh no.
I haven't seen Pete Davidson in a while. No.
no one did until he was taking photos in bed and texting them to Kanye.
Yeah.
It's just the whole situation is very interesting. And now Kanye got kicked off Instagram. So I feel like now
he got censored.
Yeah, he got kicked off.
For what?
Bullying.
He was putting up photos of people from like Google images and saying stuff, wasn't he?
He
said, what is this guy wearing? Is he influential or is he under the influence?
Well, did you see?
That's funny.
Did you see the back and forth between them?
Oh, no. Is that why he got kicked off? I didn't see why he actually got kicked off.
I'm not going to read them, but he basically... He basically was like, yo, Kanye, I'd shut the hell up. Like, somebody else was is with Kim right now.
And he chested up to him, right?
And he was saying disrespectful things.
Oh, no, I didn't see
In his response.
Who, Pete?
Yo, Pete would wash Kanye.
No.
Yeah.
You think so?
Yeah, well, of course. Pete Davidson's like 6'5".
Yeah, but he was like a stick, though.
Kanye's crazy. Yeah, I'm not fighting him.
Listen, you can't count out a man. You don't know what he's going to do.
If that doesn't describe Pete Davidson to a team.
If you can't count on a man that wears rain boots to an indoor stadium.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. I don't know. My guy
wears a mask to go watch the Super Bowl.
My man Jake Paul, get involved in this, man.
Bro, no,
He's already offered.
He wants to do a fight with him and McGregor on the card.
Uh-huh.
Putin versus Elon Musk.
Wow.
And then Kanye and Pete Davidson, a three-fight card.
That would break
By the way,
I'd pay whatever
whatever it costs, a whole Bitcoin, take it.
Like Jake Paul will be a multi-billionaire. After
yeah,
that fight.
Whatever it costs, I'm definitely taking.
And Thriller's hosting it.
Thriller.
The other thing that I think goes into this is McGregor definitely would be interested in it. Kanye, Pete Davidson, I actually don't think they would do it. But did you see the? I think it's Czech Republic. I don't hold me to it. I think that was who it was. They posted a message on Telegram talking shit to Elon Musk, calling him Elona Musk, Alana Musk, like basically calling him a girl.
Yeah.
And they were like, you're being disrespectful to Vladimir Putin. He would he would embarrass you. Like, you may be a big man, but you have no soul. Like, whatever they're saying wild shit. Yeah. And so Musk
Eastern European
screenshotted it. Put the translation up on his Twitter and then change his name on Twitter to Elona Musk.
He's great, man.
Yeah.
He's good.
Like, richest man in the world.
Yeah.
And you got nation states talking shit to you and you're just like, whatever, dude. Let me just, meme give this some too. Air.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, I got nation states saying that I couldn't beat up world leaders. Like, you're not going to Mars.
No, yeah. Who would get that though? I mean, I got to believe Putin, he was in the KGB, but you never know, man. With Elon, he might know some things.
My whole thing with this is, like, in a fight, everyone always goes like, oh, who's bigger? I seen some big-ass dudes get knocked out people who are just wild. And it feels to me like in the Pete Davidson, Kanye West is just... He's unpredictable.
He's very unpredictable.
And when he's unpredictable...
Pete Davidson's lanky, though. Well,
Pete Davidson would get tossed around by Kanye West.
Kanye, did you see him doing push-ups in Atlanta Mercedes Stadium before Donda's listening party?
With a fucking mask on?
With a mask on and a bulletproof vest. You don't walk around with a bulletproof vest on and not whoop people's ass.
The scene in the documentary where he's doing the bands is all time.
He's got the bands.
Bro, he's going like this. It's like an inch.
That's more than you've done today.
True.
Oh, man. Wrong. I don't know how we got off. Sorry.
We spiraled out of control. But
yeah,
I will say this.
Ask the question.
My parting thoughts are, in any fight, right, the better fighter usually wins the fight. However, if you have two good fighters in the bigger fight, bigger person wins. If you have two bad fighters in the bigger person wins. But whenever you have a mix in skill, then usually the higher skill wins.
That's a fair way to look at it. Yeah. I'm going with Kanye is been secretly preparing. He had the, what was the music video that came out where they had the cartoon and they put Pete Davidson in the ground?
Oh, yeah.
And everyone's freaking out. And we're like, do you guys not know these dudes are just entertainers?
Yeah. I'm laughing because off the earlier conversation, Farmer George said that for fight night, Yellen and Lagarde could be ring girls.
we got, never mind. We're not going to.
Yeah,
I forgot the question earlier.
I'm going with Jake Paul, Putin, and Kanye.
That's your card?
That card. Parlay them all together.
Elon Musk is fighting for the future of humanity and freedom and democracy. He is putting
only
Putin
one guy in that fight.
Box.
Only one guy in that fight has nuclear weapons.
That's fine, but you can't use them.
I don't know what he's going to do.
Putin literally is a honorary black belt in a sport where they step on each other's feet. That's judo. We watched the video. We pulled it up. They're stepping on each other's feet, trying to knock each other over. Not fighting.
Yeah, no. That's
like a little kid walks up to you and kicks you in the shin.
Putin could beat you up.
Putin is 5'7". You, John, could put your hand like this and he couldn't reach you.
Not even close, yeah.
Yeah, and then I have a feeling he would. I have a lot of respect for his fighting ability, even though I've never seen a second of him fight. Just based
you
off
scared?
Of, what? Not scared. No.
70-year-old man gonna beat you up.
Let's put it this way: if Putin took my Super Bowl ring, I would have gotten it back.
Ooh,
you ever heard that story?
Yeah, the Bob Kraft.
This is nice. Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks.
Debo, my bike punk.
All right, where can we send people to find more about 42 Macro?
Oh, appreciate you, man. 42macro.com. I'm on Twitter at 42macro, DDALE, DDALE. Check us out.
Awesome. We appreciate you coming on.
Always, man.
I appreciate my brother's being...
Yeah, smile on that Twitter picture. Yeah. Yeah, he's killing it.
In April, if you're going to be here for the Bitcoin conference, yep. On Saturday morning, we're having the SoFi Darty. At 10:30 a.m. 10:30 a.m. on Saturday at Venu, VENU.
What time does this end? Or not end, but what? Can I get there at noon?
We can do whatever we want.
All right, I'll be there at noon.
We're going to be there. They said they're going to have omelets. They're going to have mini chicken and waffles. They're going to have Bloody Marys, mimosas. They call it the SoFi Brunch. We call it the Darty because if there's alcohol and us...
If
and you,
you see what I'm wearing, it'll be a darty. I'll catch you guys, man. This is great.